You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dan Oliver. He is the founder and managing director of Mermican Capital, and he's been with us on several occasions before, and he always has a lot of very interesting and, I think, prescient things to say about the economy, looking back in the rearview mirror and then projecting forward. So thanks for joining me again, Daniel. It's really good to have you with me.
Always happy to be here.
And I want to talk to you about your February 14th article titled Endgame. First of all, before we get started, is for people that might want to take advantage of your insights into the market, you do put out occasionally some really important essays, I would call them. And is there a way that people can subscribe to that, Dan?
Yeah, they go to my website. It's a free subscription. I do a letter usually once a month for my investors, but I also send out to whoever wants to sign up for it. So it's not always once a month, but it usually is. And again, as you point out, I mean, I try to approach the markets through a historical perspective. I don't think human nature has changed. Mm-hmm. So looking at what's happened over the last hundreds or even thousands of years can give you a pretty good sense of where we're headed next. So that's the whole methodology that I try to bring to these markets.
Yeah, and the website, just for the benefit of our listeners, because I don't have it in front of me right now.
What is the website? Mermican.com. So Mermican. But just for your information, Myrmikes is the ancient word, a Greek word for ant. And I named the company after Herodotus' stories of ants digging up gold in Persia. And, and in 1996, some French explorers found marmots, which in ancient Persian were called mountain ants, who burrow in a gold-bearing strata of sand, and the villagers take gold dust off their whiskers. So, in fact, Herodotus had it exactly right. So, it plays into, again, looking at history to know what the future holds.
Oh, that's very interesting. I've wondered about the name, Mermican Capital. So now we know. Thanks for telling us that.
3 years of ancient Greek gives you something, I guess.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yes. Well, all right. So, well, one of the original languages, which is very important if you understand the origin of words, it can help you a lot, I think, in many
Absolutely.
Ways. Well, anyway, your February 14th piece titled Endgame that you sent out to your clients, you noted that you erroneously thought that 2015 would be the end of the current credit cycle and that it would be triggered by problems starting in China. Can you walk us through your thought process that led you to believe 2015 would be a disastrous year for the markets, and then say, and then perhaps tell us why it hasn't happened yet?
Yeah, sure. So there's the basic Austrian business cycle theory, which I adhere to, is that the banking system takes money. I mean, everyone knows this, right? You deposit money in the bank, they multiply, and they lend it out at term. And it's that maturity mismatch, which is the key thing here. So your overnight funds get used to finance a 10-year or a 30-year capital item, right? That's what they do. Yeah. They lend against these long-term assets. And so what happens is it's not consumer demand that demands all these long-term assets. It's just the banking funding it. It's the interest rates decline, and that encourages long-term assets. And nowhere has this occurred in more of a rapid and virulent fashion than China. I mean, buildings are very long-term cash flow items. They build masses of them, roads, infrastructure projects, bridges. All these things are long-term capital items for which the consumer is not demanding. I mean, much of China is still in poverty. Even the middle class that is emerging there legitimately doesn't necessarily need to have 3 apartments in these ghost cities. So it's just a huge misallocation of capital, and it always happens the same way. This is why in the crisis of 2008, we saw half-built condo buildings in Brooklyn, right? Or in 97 mm-hmm. in Asia, you saw a half-built airport. So it's always the long-term big capital items. And so China has this enormous bubble. And so I've been thinking it still may happen. That's where what happens is eventually, because there's not much consumer demand for these things, the cash flow starts to sink, and they can't mm-hmm. make their interest payments, the banks blow up, and then the crisis is upon you. And so I still think that may happen. But what happened in 2015, as you may recall, is that the Chinese stock market took a major, major decline. And this was in the hills of stories coming out right before that saying that farmers were leaving their fields because they could make in the market in a month more than they'd make in a year or 10 years farming. Right. And again, this plays into the whole thesis that people stop being productive and doing productive things, start doing speculative, unproductive things. Mm-hmm. And so at the peak of that bubble, you get the big hiccup. And what I thought was going to happen, which still might happen again, is that when China blows up, they consume roughly a third of many, many important commodities. And so when you're in the commodity business, you know a small decline in demand can result in a huge drop in price because sure. it's hard to turn a mine off. And those themselves are enormously capital-intensive businesses. And so what happens is commodity projects are blowing up. And then again, the banks that funded those projects, not necessarily funded projects in China, but funded projects that feed into China, they start blowing up and they lose their depositors' money, and that requires central banks to run in and bail them out. So there was this a chain reaction which began to happen. It began to happen. The stock market here dropped 13% in a month, and commodity mm-hmm. prices did collapse. And what happened was, and this is in the letter I wrote, is that in the 19th century, that would have been it. But in the 20th century, what they've done is because they've abandoned the gold standard, the bureaucrats can run in and create more credit and bail the situation out. This is what they did, by the way, three times in the 20s. They did three rounds of QE in the 1920s, which led to the Great Depression. And they've done the QE in our current time. When they add credit, when they bail the banks out, that works, quote unquote. It does work. It can stop the panic. But what it does is it encourages even more overcapacity to come online. It prevents the overcapacity from liquidating, and it makes it worse. So you can always solve a credit crisis with more credit, but all you do is delay the liquidation and make it much worse. And that's basically what's happened. So the Chinese, if you look at the charts, the amount of credit creation that the authorities in China, you know, stuffed down the economy, stuffed into the banks, is simply enormous, and unbelievable proportions, and they know it is. And so all the news coming out of China the last 6 months, a year, has been the Chinese government trying to figure out how they can damp down this credit creation and not create a crash. And of course, this is impossible. This is, you know, Hayek called it riding a tiger, right? The tiger right faster, and either you hang on. And it goes faster and faster. Eventually, you and so that's where the Chinese are now.
Well, you're looking at history, Dan. You know, I'm 70 years old. You're quite a bit younger than I am. But you know, people my age, we don't remember any kind of really dire. We came really close. 2008, 2009. We had some, you know, we had the dot-com debacle, then of course the housing thing. We had before that 1987, which I was a young man. I remember very well. But each and every time the central bank comes in and they keep this from completely unwinding, and so people really have the sense that the central banks are still our savior. They still can fix things. You're able to look at through the rearview mirror into history and draw the conclusions that ultimately this thing isn't going to continue on. But what do you say to people to convince them? I mean, how can you convince them that this is pathological, that it cannot go on forever?
It's very difficult because, again, as you point out, most people's experiences have been shaped in the last, since 1980, the end of the last credit crisis, because the 70s was a credit crisis. We resolved the credit through inflation instead of deflation in the 30s, but that's what it was. And since then, markets have only gone up, and really on a nominal basis, markets have been going up since 1973. And so you have a whole generation of people just programmed that markets always go up, and as long as you hang on to the long term, right, in that Siegel's book, you just stocks for the long term, you'll be fine. And again, history just simply doesn't support this. What has changed, again, is the ability of the authorities to push this story longer and taller. The whole intellectual economic movement after the Great Depression was how to prevent the banks from liquidating. And what they concluded erroneously was that what had caused it was all the depositors taking their money out, and that forced the banking system go in reverse, right? So liquidating assets and to pay the depositors out. So the solution was, don't let them do that, right? We'll cancel the gold standard so no one can take their gold out. And if they just want paper dollars, well, guess what? We can just print them up. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So in other words, they looked at a symptom and said, hey, it was the gold outflows that caused the crisis. And that is true in a way. The gold outflows did force the banks to liquidate. That's not untrue. But what they're missing is that what really caused the crisis in a broader sense was the overcapacity that had been built in the Great Depression. It was World War One that had built all these things that never liquidated in the 20s because they supported them. In our age, it wasn't a war. It was just the Federal Reserve protecting the banking system that pushes rates below where they should be and encourages all this malinvestment. So it's the same story, different origins. But the point is that is what makes the system liquidated. It's not the banks losing deposits. That's a symptom. It's this overcapacity. And you look around. I live in New York City, and everywhere I look, you see big, huge towers going up in every single neighborhood. I mean, unbelievable numbers of them, even while apartment sales and rents are falling. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. But if you have zero interest rates, if your cost of capital is zero, you can build anything. In fact, what I find stunning is that Bernanke, who's a blogger now at the Hoover Institute, his new job, he blogged that he had been taught by in his studies by I can't remember his name, Larry Summers' uncle at MIT, that at 0% interest rates, you can justify any investment. So it makes sense to flatten the Rocky Mountains to save on your gas price for trucks, right? Because the capital cost is finite, and then you have infinity to make out back your cash flows. And then the point is just an absurd argument to show how unnatural 0% interest are. And that's what Bernanke said, and he's the guy who drove rates to zero to save the system. And the point is, again, it did save the system, but it made the imbalances worse, and it makes that the ultimate resolution of this crisis is going to be worse. And again, I think that we were almost there on 15. The China ran into the day, but they've made things worse. And now the next time this system hiccups, it'll take that much more power to keep it from blowing up.
I'm wondering the Chinese leader there has consolidated his power. He has an endless regime, the way it looks. The laws have been set up. I suppose getting prepared for some very difficult times ahead through totalitarian rule, I guess, to try to
Jay. I mean, the point is, in the 30s, it was you can't pretend your gold out. And what they're all talking about now, Kenneth Rogoff and all these people, is that cash is only used by criminals and terrorists. So the next step is you can't take your cash out. And it's the same thing. It's done to solve a symptom, but it won't solve the underlying problem.
Right. The underlying symptom, the underlying problem, too much credit, malinvestment, no cash flow to service the debt. Right. And so banks start to lose money. Depositors run away from it, were it not for FDIC, with or without a gold standard. And so that's not the real problem. Well, David Stockman just noted, at least when I talked to him recently, he talked about a $1.8 trillion funding that the Treasury is going to have to come up with. There's a $1.2 trillion deficit, as you projected for the next fiscal year, as you noted in your article. And then he says that he's convinced that the Fed's going to raise interest rates four times this year. He's looking at another $600 billion that will be pulled out of the system by the Fed, if of course, things don't crash before then. And of course, that $1.2 trillion deficit is based on an assumption of GDP of 4.1%, which is pretty hefty compared to what we've had in recent times. I'm sure the Trump people, the Republicans, are suggesting that's going to happen because of the tax breaks. But now we have, of course, tariffs that are being proposed. I mean, my question for you is, where do you see this playing out? I mean, it's 1.8 trillion, or say 1.2 trillion, is 6% of GDP. And David notes that, you know, when he was in Washington in the Reagan administration, they were having conniption fits over that at the bottom of the cycle. And here we are at the top of the cycle, proposing a 6% deficit to GDP. Where's the money going to come from to buy the treasuries that's going to be required?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly the point, is that trying to mimic what Reagan did at the bottom of the credit cycle, when rates were over 20%, when the total GDP ratio of private and public debt was less than 150% of GDP, and applying it to today, when rates are still effectively zero or near zero, and the reported debt to GDP ratio is up in the 400% area, and of course the reality, that's private and public. The reality is probably much, much higher than that if you add the government obligation. So it's completely two different times to think about. But the point again is that when I'm all for tax cuts, of course, because the government is pernicious, and if you defund it, it's a good thing. But when you cut the taxes and you increase the spending, right? That's the other side of it, is that Trump's $300 billion boondoggle next 2 years, which it was only exceeded by Obama's stimulus, means you're going to have a huge deficit. And so here we're going to have the Treasury panically going to be issuing these things. The Fed says they're selling theirs too, so that's additional. So they're not rolling theirs over, which is effectively the same thing. And then China and Japan are buying them because their surpluses are in trouble. So the point is, who's going to buy these things? And the answer is nobody. I mean, not nobody, but the point is that the price will go down. That sends rates up. And this is why I put my in my missive that I'm not at all clear anymore that the crisis is going to start in China, because what's happening now is that the U.S. interest rate structure is going to head a lot higher. I mean, they teach you in business school that every single financial asset on the planet is priced on a spread to the treasury bond yield. You look at the yield of a private asset, you compare the treasury, and that's the spread, and that's how you price these things. So as the treasury bond rate goes up, it's going to make the required return for every private investment also get higher. And it's just a mathematical function. If your return goes up, your price goes down. So it's hard to imagine how this scenario isn't going to result in a sharply lower market. And I think David Stockman is right about this. Is that don't forget these guys hate Trump, and if they can raise rates four times and make the market blow up on his watch, so much the better. I do wonder, and this isn't in the letter, but I have wondered more of this since I wrote that, which is that when you have such a huge stimulus in the economy, you generally do get a big boost out of it. And we're so close to the midterm elections. Trump's popularity is rising, and it's certainly possible that he squeaks through the midterms before anything bad happens, simply because of the juicy economy's going to get. But that may not necessarily happen. And sooner or later, these enormous deficits we've been running, which haven't really mattered for 35 years, which is why I was ignoring them, but they haven't mattered in the context of falling rates. But if the deficit keeps widening in a rising rate environment, that's entirely different. And again, as I point in the paper, as people talk about, but the numbers are absolutely terrifying. The raw number of dollars required to pay the interest on the debt has been going up, even though rates have been falling because of the enormous increase in amount of debt. Well, if you start increasing the rates as well as the debt, that number explodes higher. And then what you have to do is you have to issue more treasury bonds to raise more money just to pay the interest. And then those treasury bonds have interest. So the point is you get involved very fast in an exponential increase of these things. And it won't take long for the market to project what's happening and price them accordingly. And once you project an exponential increase, the price becomes very, very low.
Yeah.
I.e. rates very, very high. And that's catastrophic to our economic system.
For sure. And markets are going to discount that looking forward, I would think, too, as they start to perceive that. I wonder if some of that discounting hasn't already started to take place. Well, one of the things you noted in your article was the correlation between gold and interest rates in the past, in the 70s, but it's gone the opposite way more recently. Most people now are thinking, well, with rising rates, we're probably going to see a stronger dollar and we're going to see a weaker gold price. But you address that issue and you have some different thoughts about what might happen in the future regarding those relationships.
Yeah, so something I talk about a lot, that is the standard Wall Street analysis is that as rates go up, gold has no cash flow. So when rates go up, on the marginal gold holder sells the gold to buy the higher yielding asset, and so therefore gold goes down. And similarly, as rates go up, the marginal international investor wants to buy a bond at a higher yield, so he's got to buy dollars first to do that, so it strengthens the dollar. That's the conventional wisdom. And to me, it's exactly backwards, and the 70s shows this. If you plot a chart of the nominal interest rate against the gold price in the 70s, it's a perfect match, i.e., as rates went up, gold went up, or the dollar went down. And the reason for this, in my view, is that, to me, there's nothing spooky about the Fed Reserve, and it doesn't really matter to me how many dollars there are. What matters to me is what backs them. If the Fed Reserve were only issuing dollars and only taking gold against it, so each dollar was backed by 100% gold, it wouldn't matter how many dollars there are because each one would be backed by gold. And so if we think about how the Fed actually works, they issue dollars against assets, against bonds, against treasury bonds. And as rates go up, bonds go down in value. And so if you have a balance sheet and the assets are falling in value, the liabilities are going to fall in value too. And that's what happened in the 70s. Rates went up, the bonds went down, the dollar went down, gold went up. my theory and why that went into reverse the last 6 years is because when you have a system like we have now, where you have $4 trillion of base money and $90 trillion of credit money, of debt denominated in that money, how do you pay back the $90 trillion with the $4 trillion? How do you even make the interest payments?
Yeah.
And so the dollar has been in a huge short squeeze, especially the euro-dollar market, when you have a non-American borrower of U.S. dollars, and they can't go to the Fed, they can't get dollars, they've got to pay them back. And as the rate goes up, what happens is you need to hold more dollars because your interest payments go up, and you need to have a reserve of dollars to pay your interest payments. If you don't pay your interest payments, you default on your debt, you lose your collateral. So no one wants to do that. And so as the rate goes up, the dollar has strengthened, i.e. it did the reverse of what it did in the 70s. And what I've been writing for the last 8 years is that at some point, that dynamic, that short squeeze of dollars will break. And when it does, the dollar will flip back to the orientation it had in the 70s, where it becomes correlated with interest rates instead of being anti-correlated. And if you look at the chart of gold and rates over the last few months, it looks to me that that's starting to happen. It's too early to say it is happening, but it looks like it's starting to happen. And to me, that's a huge, huge shift, because what it would signal when it happens is that the world is shifting from the deflation environment it's been in, with this short squeeze the dollar has been in for the last at least 6, maybe 10 years, into more of an inflation environment where rates start undermining the value of the Fed's assets. And that, to me, again, starts this positive feedback loop we saw in the 70s, where as rates go up, the dollar sinks, and that makes, you know, inflation kicks up, then you want more interest rates to protect yourself against inflation, and then repeat. And so that's when you really get the Federal Reserve's balance sheet destroyed and gold up in the stratosphere. And by the way, if you look at the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve going back to 1704, you put those things together, the market has required a backing of about one-third for the dominant central bank's liabilities in gold. And that number today comes around $6,000 an ounce. So I think $6,000 an ounce in gold is not some pie-in-the-sky crazy projection. That all that would do is put gold to back the average of where it's been for 300 years. And during most of that time, Jay, the assets that these banks held were short-term commercial bills and 90-day government bonds. Well, now they own 10 and 30-year government bonds. It's a very different thing. So I don't think 6,000 is a fair number. I think it's got to get to at least 8,000 or 10,000 to balance the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. And that is what a full credit liquidation looks like. That's what happened in 1980. That's what's going to happen today. And my guess is once the process starts, because it's a self-iterating process, it will play out very, very quickly.
All right. Well, let's look at this now. If we go back to the 70s, it was Paul Volcker came in to, to keep gold out of the picture. He promised people, gave people huge rates of interest on treasuries, 12-14% or so. My first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage back in 1981, I believe it was. And, so they saved, quote unquote, saved the system at that point and kept gold from entering. And gold price was going up. And Volcker's when he slammed on the brakes of money creation, gold was knocked in the teeth, and it fell from its $850 price level down to the 200s ultimately, and before it finally, rallied again, and we're in another bull market now. But let's think through this. Would the Fed, if we start having a real serious inflationary problem, the Fed is likely to try to reimpose, and maybe that's what they're doing now, trying to reimpose stricter monetary conditions, sending rates up, sending, the economy into a tailspin. Is that when the Fed and the central banking may find some real problems for their survival?
Yeah, I mean, I think, but by the way, I think you were at the dinner that the CMR had with Paul Volcker, and he got up.
Yes, I was.
3 years ago, and he said gold was the enemy. And he was Fed chairman, and the reason is because he said as gold was going up, it signaled to him that the system was rejecting the dollar, and when gold went down, it was the opposite. So I thought it was a very interesting comment from a Fed, the famous Fed governor, but chairman. Hey guys, yes, exactly. I mean, the Fed's knee-jerk reaction when inflation kicks up is going to be to increase rates. And in fact, I was reviewing some of the Federal Reserve minutes from the 70s when they were doing the same dynamic. They were raising rates, and they were saying in the minutes, hey, this is going to strengthen the dollar. And the opposite happened, right?
Yeah.
Because they were devaluing the bonds. Now, as those bonds rolled off and they replaced with new high-yielding ones, that balance sheet became solid again. And again, it was 100% backed by gold when gold crossed 550. And so they did save the system. But the question is, you know, what would happen in today's world with the rates of 20%? I mean, there'd be very little left standing. Certainly not the government. Certainly yeah. not the banks. Certainly not, you know, any other structures that I'm aware of can withstand that kind of economic stress test. And so they simply don't have that option unless it's in conjunction with a massive devaluation of the dollar. In other words, you can pay 20% on your dollar balances if the dollar has declined by 80% or some number like that. Mm-hmm. So the only way out becomes a huge devaluation of the dollar. And the question, how do they do it? Do they go buy a whole bunch of more government bonds and the government starts spending all the stimulus? Is that how they do it? Do they do a sudden, like, you know, weekend revaluation where they simply revalue against some asset or against gold, some other thing? It's hard to say. My guess is they don't know. I mean, these are academics. They have their models. Their models simply don't tell them what's going to happen. So they'll be reactive, not proactive. And at some point, when the world's about to end, they'll do something dramatic. And we'll have to see what it is. But whatever it is, it's going to be good for gold and bad for the dollar.
All right. We'll have to leave it go at that, Dan. We're really out of time. I want to thank you very much. Clearly, you don't want to own dollars in that circumstance. That's for sure. Gold, almost in any environment, long term, it holds its purchasing power. We know what happens to fiat currencies. They all go the way of history, the dustbin of history. Well, thank you, Dan, for being with us, and really enjoyed that. Hope to have you back again sometime soon. That is all the time we have this week, folks. Next week, David Jensen will be with me to talk about a topic I don't think gets nearly enough attention these days, and that is the impending demise of the petrodollar and what that may mean for gold and other markets. So you'll want to be with us next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.